Welcome, everybody, to the CLUIN webinar, Area-Wide Planning Coordination Opportunities. Today's edition of this series is titled Economic Development Administration and U.S. Department of Agriculture. This webinar series is sponsored by EPA's Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization. I'm Mike Adam from EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, and I will moderate today's seminar. Before I turn things over to our introductory speaker for today's seminar, there are a few logistics, and you can read some of these if you now select slide 2. If you're using a phone line, please mute your phone, but do not put us on hold. If you do not have a mute button, you can use *6 to mute. During Q&A sessions, those of you on the phone can take your phone off mute to comment and ask questions. At that time, you may hit #6 to unmute your phone if you're not using the mute function on your phone. Participants can type in questions by using the question mark icon at the top of the HTML presentation. You can do this at any time. You do not need to wait until the Q&A session to submit questions via the text form. You may also use this form to alert us of any technical problems you may be having. The presenter will alert you to which slide they're on, and you will have to manually advance each slide yourself. If you're using the HTML online version, you can navigate the presentation with the arrow buttons at the top of the screen, also as shown on slide 2. You should have already clicked the Go To Session button at the top of the seminar homepage and have the slides in front of you. After the session, you can access the feedback form and the additional resources links from the sidebar buttons on the seminar homepage, which is the homepage that you were brought to with the link that was in your email. We've also provided a link to these, which are the additional resources in the feedback form, on the last slide of the presentation. We appreciate your feedback and ask that you please fill out the form. This event is being recorded and will be archived. Again, please make sure you have muted your phone, and you may use *6 to mute your phone if it does not have a mute function. With that, it's time to begin today's session. I'm going to turn it over to today's speakers. Rachel?
Hi. Thank you all for joining. This is Rachel Dietz from EPA's Office of Brownfields and Land Revitalization. This webinar will cover programs from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Economic Redevelopment Agency. Hopefully, these will help communities as they begin area-wide plans for brownfields impacted areas. Charlie Barch from the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response and David Ives from the Economic Development Agency will be presenting today. So, Charlie, I'm turning it over to you.
Well, thank you, Rachel. I want to welcome everybody to our third webinar on resources that are available to area-wide planning grantees. I'm Charlie Barch, and I'm senior advisor to Maddie Stanislaus, who's the assistant administrator in the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. I want to mention that we've worked very closely with USDA in pulling this together, and we've got some contact information that we can forward to you on some contacts and some questions. Today's webinar is going to emphasize more of the smaller communities that are some of the area-wide planning grantees. There's eight actually that would fall within some of these smaller town and rural definitions that are applicable at USDA. So this webinar is really aimed at those smaller communities. EDA puts a lot of its resources into smaller towns, although larger cities, you know, also can take advantage of EDA. And like, as Rachel mentioned, and you know, after we finish talking about USDA, we'll be joined by David Ives, who's the sustainability coordinator at EDA and has been very, very active in EDA's efforts to kind of figure out how brownfields can fit within their mission and how their resources can be applied. So if we go to the next slide, which I believe is slide 4, just to give you some sense of the programs we're going to cover here today, we're going to talk about really USDA's core programs for rural development and rural redevelopment, their community facilities programs, the business and industry programs, and some of their rural development grants. I also want to mention a couple of fairly specific funding opportunities that some of the grantees might be able to take advantage of depending on what their vision is for end use of the brownfield sites. And then David Ives is going to cover the public works, economic adjustment, and planning support programs at EDA. If we go to slide 5, we can just jump right in. But I guess one of the things I want to mention in terms of USDA's rural development objectives, I mean, they have a pretty broad mission when it comes to rural development, and certainly in the context of applying these resources to brownfield situations, that broad, flexible set of objectives, I think, can really be used to help us make some good connections. I mean, as you can see on the screen, their objectives are to increase economic opportunities and improve the quality of life for rural Americans, and it's based on the idea that a rural America that is healthy, safe, and prosperous is a good place to be. Clearly, brownfield revitalization can play an important part in achieving these objectives. And before we get into some of the specific programs, I just want to provide, I think just a couple of overview observations on how that might work. I think it's important to remember with USDA, as with other programs, they don't have a brownfields program per se, but their program objectives and their eligible activities and their other requirements really can fit very well, in some cases, to a brownfield revitalization strategy that a community is trying to carry out. USDA rural development funds, like many programs, need to meet broadly defined program objectives. We're going to go through four programs that can do this in a brownfield context. But I think I just want to mention in general, when you're thinking about USDA and you're thinking about meeting these objectives, what that means really when you kind of get down to the project level, that there's a number of links that can be made between USDA rural development programs and brownfields. I mean, some of their eligible activities include things like planning for redevelopment or revitalization, planning to support, business development, planning to support community, amenities, community facilities development. When you get down to the bricks and mortar level, the USDA programs can be used for a range of site clearance and preparation activities, including demolition, key activities that you may need to, incorporate into your brownfield strategy. They can be used for rehabilitation or improvement of sites or structures, which also can be really key brownfield functions. They can be used for construction, real estate improvements, new facilities. Again, depending on what you want to do, they fit right into those strategies. And I think one of the things that a number of these programs can also do, which can be very helpful when you're looking at brownfield revitalization in an area-wide context, is the fact that they can be used to help, build or install amenities that communities can use to enhance development and enhance the marketability of these areas. So there's a number of things these programs can do. And I think sort of the real key message in an area-wide planning context is that there's a lot of potential with USDA programs to meet a whole range of brownfield cleanup and redevelopment needs, because these can really complement the USDA rural development objectives. So having got those observations out there, let's kind of dig right in to the next slide, which is slide 6. Take a look at one of the real key programs that's out there, and this is USDA's Business and Industry Guaranteed Loan Program. Again, this is a program, as it says, it provides guaranteed loans. It's not grants, but the guarantees can be very helpful in sort of attracting private investment, in prying loose, resources from banks because of the comfort that the guarantee provides. USDA, through this program, will guarantee loans to private or public organizations for a range of activities. Some of the key things that they traditionally do are industrial park site development or rehabilitation, or providing access to, industrial parks, commercial centers, that create jobs. But it's not limited to this, but these are the key activities that they provide. I think the key here is the fact that it's really a program that focuses in large part on private development activities. There's not a lot of resources out there that private, interested parties can readily access. This program and the guarantees may give you as a community a good entree to invite them to consider these sites, to participate in your plans, and to really join you as a partner. Eligible borrowers, who can borrow money that can be guaranteed through this program include, cooperatives, private corporations, partnerships, You know, other entities organized on a profit or nonprofit basis. This provides a good way to encourage, participation by nonprofits, tribes, any range of public bodies and individuals. So pretty much any stakeholder that you can identify in an eligible community that might have an interest in brownfield redevelopment is worth considering in the context of this program. If we move on to the next slide, which is slide 7, really what can they borrow for? Again, remember that, they need to borrow this money, which is guaranteed, which I realize may be a constraint in some cases, but it is a way of accessing capital because the eligible activities are really pretty broad. Business and industrial acquisitions, if you're in a situation where you're facing a business closure, a plant closure, departure, of pretty much any kind of business entity that has jobs associated with it, that's eligible. I think the next one is really key in the context of proactive brownfield revitalization strategies. I mean, the money can be used to support business conversion, enlargement, repair, modernization, or development. A real key question as you're thinking about doing this, what role does site assessment, cleanup as part of a larger redevelopment play, and how might those activities be integrated into the larger business plan, the larger lending package that's going to be guaranteed? So again, something to think about in this context. It also can be used for the purchase and development of land. Again, real key activities in the brownfield reuse strategy, easements, right-of-ways, buildings or facilities, as well as, the purchase of equipment or leasehold improvements in machinery and supplies or inventory. So a whole range of activities can be supported through these guarantees, and these guarantees and these projects, can fit, depending on your intended end use as part of your area-wide plan, can fit very well into this. I mean, clearly, in an area-wide planning context, it really allows you an entree and an opportunity to work with businesses within your brownfield areas. It may be, attracting new businesses. It may be, retaining anchors that are already there. There's a number of things that can be done. If we can move on to the next slide. Slide 8. Things to consider here. A borrower needs to be, engaged in or proposing to engage in a business that is going to provide, employment opportunities. I think a key question to probe, with your USDA reps as you're thinking about, partnering up on a guarantee is, how does retention play into this, if that's a factor for you? I think a real key one is a thing to consider. These guarantees need to improve the economic or environmental climate, and those are words right from the USDA rules and mission. Improve the economic or environmental climate. This gives you significant brownfield flexibility, to approach this. And at the same time, one of the things that I want to mention is the fact that USDA does not have a brownfields program. If you go and talk to USDA and say, I've got this great brownfield project, they may or may not completely understand or support what you want to do. It's really important to frame it in their terms. You're doing a project that will help improve the economic or environmental climate of an area. And, other activities, too, again, depending on what you want to do, there are some water connections and also some renewable energy connections. So if you're talking about doing a project and you may be, installing a renewable energy facility, a small-scale solar, even a combined heat and power, there may be some opportunities to use these programs. And who's eligible? Well, what areas are eligible? Under this program, rural is defined as basically, all as areas that have less than 50,000 population and are not sort of a suburb, if you will, or a contiguous community to an urbanized area. So if you've got a freestanding town, 50,000 or less, that's great. If you're in a suburb, it may not work. It's also a good point to mention, and we'll mention this again later, depending on the USDA program, your sort of population cutoffs vary by program. This is a significant program in terms of the dollars available. I was trying to find the FY11 budget numbers. Sorry, I had this little technical issue here. Trying to find the FY11 budget numbers. I believe there's about $950 million in total available for guarantee authority. I guess so a maximum national guarantee level of $950 million. In terms of just a few specifics related to this program, it is a lender-driven program. The commercial lender, you know, applies to the USDA program for the loan guarantee, and it makes and services the loan. The maximum guarantee provided to the lender is generally 80% for loans up to $5 million, 70% for loans up to $10 million, and 60% for loans between $10 and $25 million. This can be used for a pretty much the entire gamut of project sizes, very small ones, and projects up to $25 million. Cooperative organizations, you know, rural co-ops can apply, you know, as an entity for up to $40 million, you know, to distribute amongst eligible entities. So there's a lot of resources available. It can cover a full range of program sizes. I'm going to give a couple of examples at the end, but I'd be glad to take any questions on this program now if I can answer them. And if not, you know, we can certainly get answers for you from our USDA contacts and get those back to you. Anything right now?
If there's anybody on the phone, you can press #6 to unmute to ask your question.
This is Bahram from Huntington Park, CDE. Just want to make sure this doesn't apply to, again, to like all these small cities in LA County, right? Is for
You know, LA County, you know, I mean, we would want to get, you know, I don't want to write that off. My guess is it does not apply, but, you know, we should check.
Hi.
Part of it depends on where you're located.
Charlie?
You know, within that, yeah.
This is Rachel.
Yes.
On USDA.gov, they have some location finders that will tell you in a broad sense if you're eligible for, if your area is eligible for their loans.
That's a great tip. Thank you for adding that in. Okay. Well, let me move on to the next set of programs. And these are the rural development grants. There's two grants that we want to mention. The Rural Business and Economic Grants and the Rural Business Opportunity Grants in USDA jargon known as RBAG and RBOG. These grants are given to provide operating capital and finance private business and industry. I mean, sort of basically the way it's thinking about this is, again, it's two types of grants, sort of two related missions, but basically the RBAGs are your sort of bricks and mortar grants. And your RBOGs are your sort of training and technical assistance grants. And as you can see, you know, on the bottom of the slide, the funds can be used for training and technical assistance for business development and entrepreneurs and, you know, economic development officials. And you have to do a whole range of activities. I just want to take a minute to talk about a couple of the specifics of RBAG and RBOG, you know, before we get into the next slide. The RBAG program provides grants for rural projects that finance and facilitate development of small and emerging rural businesses. Very interesting. I mean, it's a small program, but it can really be a good niche program if you want to do things like, for example, small business incubators or sort of, you know, standalone small business development. You know, in terms of the size of these grants, the rules don't really prescribe any maximum level. But it's a competitive program, and smaller projects are given higher priority in that competition. And just sort of the history of the program, the grants typically range in size from $10,000 up to $500,000. Most of them are sort of in the $50,000 to $100,000 range in practice, just to give you some sense as to where they sit. And in terms of the RBOG, you know, the business opportunity grants, really the purpose of these grants is to promote sustainable economic development in rural communities. These grants are used to pay for the cost of providing economic planning for rural communities. You know, I mean, obviously you all have your area-wide planning grants. If there's additional planning needs that you really, you know, come across, I mean, in RBOG in a small community, this could be an opportunity. They also provide for they can also be used for technical assistance for rural businesses or training for rural entrepreneurs. You know, one of the possibilities here, you know, again, sort of keeping with the spirit of the RBOG program, but also looking to the needs, you know, of a brownfield area-wide planning strategy, I mean, the extent to which at some point you would need to do sort of specific training on brownfield issues, on how to, you know, connect with your state voluntary cleanup program, things like this, you know, information and outreach, clearly those kinds of activities would be eligible to use an RBOG for. So again, something to think about, you know, as you're preparing, you know, to your plan and thinking about what you want to do, just in terms of size. Last year, most of the RBOG grants were $50,000 or less. Nationally, the program had about $2.5 million, which it distributed. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of background information on that. And Rachel, if you could tell us what slide we're on. I've had a technical difficulty. My screen has blacked out, so I don't know where we're at in terms of number. If you could just tell people where we're at, we're going to move on to the next one, which is the eligible entities for RBIG and RBOG.
Eligible entities is slide 10.
Thank you. I'm getting sort of back online here, but I just have kind of lost track for a second. In terms of the eligible entities for, you know, these two grant programs, this one is not available directly to private parties. I mean, the eligible entities are sort of, you know, public entities, you know, public bodies, you know, towns, townships, things like that, nonprofits. Again, you know, your rural CDCs, some of your rural, you know, development, you know, quasi-public corporations could play an important role here, and tribes. And as well as cooperatives that have primarily rural members. You know, clearly there's a range of entities out there that could be used for this. Okay. We can move on to slide 11. Just to give you some sense as to what is eligible under these programs. Again, it's the categories are pretty broad, and you know, and some of the recent activities that these grants have funded, particularly, well, you know, I mean, you can just kind of see, you know, things like, you know, development of export markets, feasibility studies. I know that was clearly an activity that some of the area-wide planning grantees were honing in on. You know, the RBOG can be used for that. You know, trade strategies. You know, community economic development planning, training. You know, business incubators, you know, assistance with technology-based economic development. And I just want to mention, too, that, you know, certainly when you focus sort of specifically on the RBAGs, which I mentioned are the more bricks and mortar of the two, you know, what that program has funded in recent years has included things like, you know, acquisition or development of land, easements, or right-of-way. Again, activities that fit very nicely into a brownfield strategy, construction, you know, conversion, renovation of buildings, you know, plant retrofits, you know, machinery purchase, you know, access streets and roads, parking areas, you know, utilities, pollution control and abatement. And there's been a couple of RBAGs that have actually been used to capitalize small revolving loan funds, you know, including loans that will make, including RLS that will make loans for startups and working capital. So there's a lot of flexibility here. And certainly to my way of thinking, you know, the more flexibility you have, you know, the more opportunities you can take advantage of, you know, to link your brownfield needs to some of these programs. So just moving on to the next slide, number 12, just some things to consider. No, the same definition applies here as it did to the BNI program. You know, cities or towns of less than 50,000, as long as they are not part of a metro area, suburb or contiguous to one of these. Okay, let's move on to the next slide, number 13. This gets into the community facilities. Actually, before I do that, does anybody have any questions on RBEX or RBOX? Just to recap, small programs, niche programs, and if you can make it fit your niche, I mean, there's a lot of opportunity to inject a small amount of resources, to kind of plug a significant gap in your planning strategy. Any questions?
Charlie, the only question that I had that came in through the text right now is people are wanting to know. This is back to the previous program that you talked about, the
sure.
Lawrence.
Uh-huh.
They want to know the location, the URL for the location finders to see if the area is eligible, and maybe we can get that for them later.
Okay, and maybe, I don't know if, Rachel, you have an opportunity to hunt that down while you're on the call. I am back online with my screen, so I should be able to keep track of the slides, and then if we could get that, and if not, we'll get that out via email as soon as we can.
I am looking it up right now.
Thanks. Actually, while she's doing that, and before I get into the community facilities, loans, and grants, I mean, if people are out there and just want to get some sense as to what some of these programs have funded, and I guess I would say that, I think there is more potential creativity in using these programs than might be obvious from looking, but USDA's website does have a mechanism by which you can go state by state and pull down sort of lists and then links to funded projects. So you get some sense as to what has gotten funded in your state and why that may be important. I mean, we'll get to this towards the end, but, the state USDA offices have a lot of, I'll say, a lot of authority, a lot of latitude in sort of advocating for certain kinds of projects that they'd like funded within the broad confines of the program, so you get some sense as to what interests them, and it also gives you some sense as to what you might want to talk to them about as you're putting together applications. All right, let me move on to, again, we're on slide 13, the community facilities, loans, and grants. This program really focuses on, as it says, community facilities. But it's available for a wide range of development and community benefit projects. It's very flexible in the kinds of activities and the kind of projects it can cover. And I think the real value in this program is you're thinking in an area-wide context, as you're thinking in a broader community revitalization context, it allows you to think about what kinds of, public amenities, community facilities are really needed to make your area attractive for private investment and use this program to get those pieces of your area-wide plan put into place. As you can see from this slide, the activities include, constructing or enlarging or improving facilities, things like, healthcare, public safety, community and public services, and in fact, even to kind of, give some specifics about, what that means in practice. I mean, in terms of, it can be things like, if health services are, for your community are a piece of your revitalization puzzle, it can do things like, help, support, construction, of hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, assisted living facilities. It can support cultural and educational facilities as part of the community facility strategy. That would be things like, libraries, museums, outdoor theaters, child care centers, charter schools, a whole range of activities like that. If you need sort of basic, public safety services, it can support things like, communication centers, fire department buildings. It can even help with things like fire truck purchases if providing fire services, is a potential barrier to your larger community-wide redevelopment. It can do a whole range of things like that. It can provide, community, support buildings, community centers, jails, if that's an issue for you. You know, things like this, if food storage and distribution centers, data processing, a whole range of things. And in terms of transportation, this is clearly, an area that I know some of the area-wide grantees are, looking to promote, industrial commercial, strategies. So things like, bridges, sidewalks, off-street parking, infrastructure for industrial parks or eligible activities. I know on my list of eligible activities, railroads are on there. I'm not sure what the fine print is on that. I know that in Kalispell, one of their things that they'd like to do is figure out how to deal with a railroad as part of their area-wide, and so that actually may merit some investigation on our part just to see what that means in terms of, railroads in the context of community facilities. But there's a whole range of things that can support this, and I guess I just like to mention that, because, as you're thinking, broadly about your area, there just may be some of these things that can really make your area more attractive, attract, businesses in, or in the case, I know there's, some, public open space ideas in some of these. There just may be some possibilities to make these kinds of connections. So, again, just think about that, as to work. To go on to the next slide, number 14, the eligible entities, very similar to the other USDA. In this case, again, it's not for private, but it's for public entities such as municipalities, counties, special purpose districts, which would include townships, and the whole range of, special, utility districts, et cetera, that are really, in many places in rural America. Nonprofit corporations can be a key player in this, tribes. What these entities have to have is they need to have the legal authority, for construction, operation, and maintenance of the proposed facility, and they also need to be unable to get funds from commercial sources at reasonable rates and returns. In this program, the population is limited to 20,000 or less, so this is one of those programs.
Hey, Charlie, I had a question come in, regarding what it can be used for, probably previous slide 13.
Okay.
And the question is, would it support installation of sewer systems, these community facility loans? Or grants?
We would want to verify that, but I know that there, I'm going to give an example in a minute of a project in New Hampshire that supported a community-wide septic system. I'm just looking at this detailed list that I pulled down. That's worth checking, just given that the categories that they list, linked to, infrastructure, and linked to some of these things. I think that's one of those we would want to, get a specific call on that. Some of that may depend on what exactly it is. If you're talking about rebuilding an entire community's, water and sewer system, that may not work. If you're talking about, providing sewer and water access to a building site, it probably would work. So that's actually something, whoever put that question in, we should, follow up with them and get them a specific answer related to the specific situation they've got in mind.
Okay. And do we have information, I don't know if you're going to get into this, regarding interest rates and loan terms, or is that something we would have to provide links?
Well, I guess I'd answer that question in this way. Certainly in the case of the BNI, and actually in the community facilities too, when you're doing the loan part, the basic rules are that it's sort of negotiable. I mean, there's a lot of rules that kind of come down to that. The terms are negotiated between, borrower and lender. There's not a defined cap on those. What we've seen in the context of certainly the business and industry loan guarantees is the availability of the guarantee, often means that the borrower has more leverage in negotiating those terms. Certainly in the case of the business and industry, I know the terms are available. The basic real estate terms are for up to 30 years, and it's up to, 15 years for, equipment. So it can be, in terms of the term length, it can be advantageous. In terms of the term rate, it's negotiable. It's usually, it's typically comparable to sort of most favored borrower type rate. But again, it's flexible.
Okay.
Just we're on slide 15. I just wanted to, before I go into the examples, just mention very quickly a couple of targeted USDA programs. Again, these are headquarters-based programs. Depending on what you want to do with your site, they may be helpful. The first one I want to mention is the Farmers Market Promotion Program, or FMPP in USDA terms. This is a program that provides non-construction grants that really focus on farmers markets and producer-to-consumer market opportunities. So the extent to which you may have, you know, a brownfield site or an area within or a site within your area-wide target area that you might want to use as a farmers market, you know, either as a permanent use or as an interim use, this program might be helpful. If we go to the next slide, 16, you can just see, you know, who's eligible to tap into resources under this program. Again, you know, co-ops, networks, associations, local governments, pretty much the full range of brownfield stakeholders can tap into this. So if a farmer's market is in your vision, this may be a program to think about. And if we go on to the next slide, slide 17, sort of a related program, another one to think about, again, is the USDA program that focuses on wholesale markets and facility design. This one can provide guidance and technical support if you're thinking about building or remodeling, you know, a wholesale market, a farmer's market, a public market. So if the extent to which these kinds of things, you know, may be good permanent uses, may be good interim uses, you know, at some of the sites you've identified within your area-wide, you know, planning area, it's something to think about. There is a lot of flexibility, you know, in what facilities can be supported. It can be indoor or outdoor facilities. It can be single buildings or, you know, or complexes. Most of these projects are driven by a local nonprofit or a local government entity. Again, and it might be a good fit or a good complement in some cases. Just quickly, on the next slide, number 18, you know, some of the wholesale markets and facility design activities that are eligible. And you can, you know, these resources can be available for pre-design, you know, market analysis for some of the designing needs and some of the construction and operational phases of the project, you know, and they can provide advice on facilities management or energy efficiency. So while it may not cover all the bricks and mortar activities, the extent to which you want to, you know, come up with some, you know, marketing and design resources to push this kind of activity in your area, this may be a program to consider. I don't know off the top of my head. I didn't do a lot of digging on this one. I wasn't sure how applicable it would be. I would be happy to do that digging to find out sort of, you know, sort of application pointers and resource levels on this one. I just want to give four brief examples of you know, how these programs have been used in different places. The first one I want to mention, I like this one just because of the name of the area. This is the Brownfield Project in Greenfield, New Hampshire. Small town, small site. It was part of an abandoned steel site. This is a little older project. I put this in here because this one used a community facilities loan. This was a critical piece of the project funding, and this was used to, you know, redevelop this abandoned steel site into a community septic system and an open space park. The next example I want to mention is in Seaford, Delaware. This one used a rural development loan available to it. This is a former sewing machine factory that has been converted to mixed-income housing in Seaford, Delaware. It was the USDA Rural Development Loan, you know, plus Delaware Housing Authority and private bank participation that made this possible. I think a real issue here is when this project was underway, this is also a project that's a couple of years old, but a real issue here was dealing with the brownfield stigma. There was a lot of concern that, you know, they take this old sewing machine factory, no one would want to live there because it was a brownfield site. It was a contaminated site. And I think what this project really showed is that, you know, that these resources could be pulled together, that the USDA could be a critical piece of a funding package that included, you know, private and other public sources. And you could really do housing, you know, in an infill way in a small community. And I think the stigma issue was really addressed. I mean, they did the ribbon cutting in early January of 06, and less than 3 months later, the thing was fully occupied, and it remains occupied today. So I got a very interesting example of USDA playing a critical role. The next one I want to do, this is an interesting project to me, just because the B word, brownfields, really has never really entered into any of the, you know, site publicity or anything like that. But it's sort of like, you know, when you connect the dots, you're talking about a former electric power plant that was built in 1920, sat empty in this small town for more than 20 years. So, you know, they may have not used the brownfield word in this. Clearly, it had perceptions of contamination that went with it. Also, a very small town. It has been converted into a small business incubator. Also, a very interesting blend of resources. I mean, we're not focusing on HUD today, but the HUD Small Cities Program provided a key piece of this, as did the USDA Rural Development Business and Industry Grant. Again, this was a distressed community, and it has been converted into a small business incubator in Walt Hill. And the final example I want to mention, I've used this example before. It is one of my favorite examples of how, you know, really USDA participation can help in a community. This is Potosi, Wisconsin, small town.
Charlie, I want to get everybody on the same page. We're on slide 22.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got carried away with my examples, and I forgot. We're on page slide 22. Thanks, Michael. This is the Potosi Brewery in Potosi, Wisconsin. Potosi, small town. This project was key to really, I don't think I'm exaggerating by too much in saying that this has really helped save this town and turn it around. It was an old brewery. It had been abandoned. It caught fire. It had all sorts of problems. It was right in the heart of Potosi. It was a $3.3 million, you know, business and industry guaranteed loan, which proved absolutely critical in securing the additional resources needed to take this project from assessment and cleanup through redevelopment. You know, we're focusing on USDA, but the USDA resources were critical in attracting and leveraging technical assistance from the National Trust for Historic Preservation, a Historic Preservation Challenge Grant, and some other resources. It has transformed Potosi's Main Street. It's been refurbished as a microbrewery and a brewing museum. It opened in June of 2008. This town of 700 people attracted 50,000 visitors last year to come visit the brewery, and I wanted to go and be number 50,001, but I didn't get a chance to make it. I think more importantly, it has created 50 new jobs and really generated a lot of spin-off commercial activity on Main Street. You know, restaurants, shops, cafes, the whole kinds of tourist infrastructure that supports 50,000 visitors a year. And again, it was the USDA B&I guarantee that was really critical to that. I just want to close before I turn this over to David Ives, just with a little bit of a reality check on USDA and points to think about, as you're considering some of the USDA resources. And a couple of points. One is, you know, As a community, you know, you make your applications for all the programs we've talked about to your state USDA office on a rolling basis. And these offices are critical players in this project. The way the USDA program competitions are set up, these state offices have significant influence in the project funding decisions. In some of the programs, the USDA state office has the ability to assign 20 or 25 points out of a 100-point scale to projects that it really wants to promote within that state. So I guess if there's one piece of advice as you're really thinking about that, really befriend your state USDA office people. I mean, they can really be key in helping you work your way through this application process. Population, I mentioned, the programs go up to 50,000, and except for community facilities, up to 20,000. But the way a lot of the funding decisions are made, the way the USDA office discretion plays out, it's not a hard and fast rule, but often the smaller the community, the more interest there is in helping it, the more competitive their proposal may be. It's important to remember that, in the business and industry, this is the program. If you want to really entice, encourage, attract your private sector players, more directly, it's the business and industry program that is the key to doing that. And as you're looking at USDA programs, it's important to remember that, not every program covers every business type, but when you look across the gamut of programs, really the full range of business, commercial, industrial, housing, essential community facility projects can tap into one of these programs or another, and they can just really be vital resources for you to consider, if your town size works, in the context of your brownfield area-wide planning strategy. With that, I think I've run a little over. Pardon?
Speaking of which, I found the eligibility website on USDA.
Right.
It's http://eligibility.sc.gov/eligibility.
Great.
And I emailed it to you and Michael, and I'll email it to everyone who's participating today.
Great. Thanks so much, Rachel, for tracking that down, because, that's actually a key piece of information.
We did have one question. Questions?
Yeah, we had one question come in regarding the Farmers Market Promotion Program.
Sure.
And they wanted to know whether or not that program had to serve a rural community or could it be used for urban communities as well.
I need to check on that. I believe that program is available to all communities as long as it fits that, but I need to confirm that fact. So if whoever had that question could email me. My email is on the first slide. I'll track that down, and I'll get an answer back to them, and then we'll also get it out to the network.
I have a question here. Bahram at CB Huntington Park in Los Angeles. My understanding was that from one of the workshops in Philadelphia was that the USDA also supports urban agriculture and some of the and also I wanted to ask as my second question was that if our brownfield area is in the city, but we have an arrangement with a co-op in the rural area, does that partnership qualify for this program, FMPP?
That is a very interesting and very creative idea. I think, I guess we would need to confirm that, but, the information that I have on the eligibility, you would need to use your rural partner as sort of the front person on that, but, I don't see why that wouldn't qualify. But we need to confirm that. But that is such a creative way of kind of getting at this program. With respect to I mentioned just two other things. Obviously we were limited in what we could cover in the webinar today. And if specific questions come in, along the lines of what you've talked about in your questions, of course we'll be glad to answer those and get that information out. But basically USDA is supporting urban ag through some of their technical assistance programs. And I think, sort of the mechanics of how that's going to work are still being, worked out, how best that their technical assistance network can be tapped for that purpose. I know that Ann Carroll in the Brownfield office has been reaching out to them, and Rachel and Amy and I are going to reach out to our rural development contact, and that's one of the questions on our list. And just a general technical assistance resource, again, and depending on the area, it may be more or less responsive, or you may have to wait more or less amount of time to get some help. But the Rural Extension Service, operates everywhere in the country, and they have rural, ag extension agents who, you know, have information on hand, you know, specific situations. I do know that that some of them have been getting more actively involved in farmers market type issues and situations and may be helpful. But that really depends on the area that you're operating in.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Dave Ives, are you on the line?
I am here.
All right. We're going to turn it over to you. I'm really pleased to introduce David Ives from the Economic Development Administration, EDA. He is the sustainability coordinator there, and I think from a personal note, has been really a longtime friend and partner of the EPA Brownfields efforts going back to years when we were young, Dave. So I'm going to turn it over to you.
Yes. Thank you very much, Charlie. It's a pleasure to be with you and be with everyone. Let me just start off by telling you a little bit about the Economic Development Administration. The EDA is the economic development arm of the U.S. Department of Commerce. And let me just also say that I'm going to kind of hit slides 23, 24, and 25 kind of together. So I'll let you guys know when I move on to slide 26, where we'll start kind of going through the slides more closely. But EDA is the economic development arm of the U.S. Department of Commerce. And as such, we provide grant-based, what we call investments, but they are grants, to units of state and local government and nonprofits in communities and regions that are suffering from economic distress. And we define that distress as either places of high unemployment, low per capita income, or some type of special need, which is a disruption to the underlying economic base of a particular community or region, often caused by either natural forces or man-made instances where a major plant may be leaving or a BRAC closure, something along those lines. And what we're trying to do primarily is create an environment in which we're creating these vibrant regional economic ecosystems. And what we mean by that, by economic ecosystems, are areas where, you know, the regions have a good understanding of their particular community and region and area's talent pool, and that the connections are being fostered among the different players in that particular community, whether it be the private sector, the public sector, the nonprofit sector, educational sector. Second, we want to make sure that these economic ecosystems have the right innovation infrastructure in place. And that's not just the typical, you know, kind of bricks and mortar infrastructure that EDA has been known for, but also things specifically like wet labs and broadband and research parks, things that are really key to innovation. And it's not just hard infrastructure. It's also access to capital and making sure that the right skills exist in that workforce. So it's educational infrastructure and capital infrastructure. And finally, these economic ecosystems have the right support systems in place, meaning they have the tools necessary to accelerate entrepreneurship and to really turn research into marketable goods and services. So these are things like business incubators and R&D commercialization centers and proof of concept facilities, things along those lines. But the end goal really is to create an environment in which we are creating jobs and private capital investment. That's key for EDA investments. We want to make sure that our investments are resulting in job creation. When we're talking about job creation, we're not talking about short-term job creation, construction jobs. We're talking about the longer-term jobs that are associated with longer-term economic prosperity. Now, from a brownfields perspective, we support and have supported brownfields since EDA was created back in the mid-60s. And unlike some of our friends at the other federal agencies, we don't have a separate brownfield program. But because of our mission, a number of our key grant programs can be used for brownfields redevelopment. And in many ways, we're very much complementary to EPA. And that if you think about EPA focused on that kind of that upfront assessment and mitigation side of the brownfield equation, EDA is very much focused on the back end. We're focused on the reuse, the redevelopment portion of brownfield transactions. And it should be noted, too, that historically, you know, over 50% of EDA's infrastructure-related investments have gone to rural areas. So I know in some cases some folks think about EDA and they think urban, but you really shouldn't. We work in both urban and rural areas. And in between fiscal year 01 and fiscal year 10, actually 32% of our brownfield-related investments were made in rural areas. So I want to kind of get into the actual programs now, starting with slide 26, which is our public works grant. And public works is really our traditional bricks and mortar type of infrastructure investments, where we're focusing on the construction of essential public infrastructure. So this could be the form of roads, sewers, broadband, things of that nature. And that traditionally has been the largest amount of funding that EDA has traditionally gone to the public works sector. That may be shifting a little bit, but traditionally that's the case. As you move on to slide 27, the next grant program is Economic Adjustment Assistance, which is actually EDA's most flexible program, because you can do everything in Economic Adjustment Assistance that you can do throughout EDA. You can do upfront strategic economic development planning. You can do technical assistance. You can do that infrastructure construction. You can even do capitalization or recapitalization of a revolving loan fund. But the key with EAA assistance is it really needs to be focused on that disruption to the underlying economic base of a particular region or area. And the final bullet on slide 27 is very important to note. For both public works and economic adjustment assistance, these investments that we make need to be part of or be aligned with that particular community or region's comprehensive economic development strategy, with the goal, of course, that we don't want to do one-off investments. We want to make sure that our investments are part of a larger plan or roadmap in terms of economic development for that particular community or region. Moving on to slide 29, planning. EDA provides funding for both long and short-term planning. By short-term planning, I'm talking about shorter kind of project-based planning activities. And that smaller pool of funding for that. The bulk of the funding under the planning program goes to fund the creation and the implementation of these comprehensive economic development strategies through our network of 380 economic development districts across the country. So this funding goes to kind of implement the SEDs, these long-term roadmaps of economic development for these regions, as well as kind of keep these economic development districts kind of implementing their individual sets and keeping them up to date. Slide 30 kind of goes a little bit more into what I just mentioned about partnership planning grants. It also it's just the EDDs, but also a number of tribal organizations that receive these partnership planning grants, which I think currently is up to 58. Slide 31 talks a little bit about technical assistance. And basically, with our technical assistance grants, we're providing funding to communities so that they, in effect, can make better economic development decisions. So these often take the form of impact analyses, feasibility studies, things along that line. And it also includes funding that we provide for our University Center program, where we actually are providing funding to universities across the country, which in turn make their resources available to communities to help in a number of different economic development efforts and activities. Slide 232 is the Global Climate Change Mitigation Incentive Fund. And this really is like a green version of economic adjustment that I just mentioned, the most flexible program in that, as I said, you could do all the planning, the technical assistance, the infrastructure construction. But here, in addition, there needs to be the project needs to be focused on a specific type of economic development. So economic development project that either focuses on renewable energy, energy efficiency, reuse, recycling, or restoration, or green building, and it needs to have a particular project output. And by that, it's either a green end product, and that's broadly defined as, you know, it could be a thing, but it could also be a program or an activity. We're talking about another product output is greening of an existing function or process. thinking about the life cycle of something and greening that. Most traditionally, you can think of sustainable manufacturing as something that would have a functional process that could be greened through a portion of EDA funding. And then the creation or renovation actually to a green building is the third project out there. Slide 33, a couple things to think about when you're thinking about EDA funding. First, to reiterate that concept of making sure that the project that you're thinking of, the implementation of your planning activities is associated with that particular region's comprehensive economic development strategy. I can't stress that enough. So normally the first step in seeking out EDA funding would be to get in touch with either, your particular economic development district in which your community may fall, and or getting in touch with our regional office. We have 6 regional offices across the country, and we have a state point of contact for every state, and really they're designed to help kind of walk you through the process, kind of hold your hand and kind of crafting and developing potential EDA grant applications. I should also note, too, that EDA traditionally it was on a rolling grant process, but just this year we transferred to a quarterly funding cycle where we're now having different grant opportunities on a quarterly basis. So please keep that in mind in your planning and when you're discussing potential applications with our regional office staff. And another important point to keep in mind as well is that, you know, we're looking to see, make sure that these grant programs that we have and the grants that we make are implementing some of the key investment priorities of our leadership here at EDA and the administration overall. So we want to see these investments support concepts of collaborative regional innovation, you know, groups and communities working across jurisdictional boundaries and focused on developing and leveraging the particular assets of their particular region, not just community. Public-private partnerships, a various wealth of national strategic priorities, global competitiveness, you know, seeing what we can do to help in the making sure that the communities and the businesses within those communities have the ability to eventually export their particular products and services. Environmentally sustainable development, I mentioned that through the Global Climate Change Fund, but we also like to see not just our Global Climate Change Fund used for a lot of those green-type investments, but our other funding pools as well used for environmentally sustainable development. And then economically distressed and disadvantaged communities. And what we're talking about there is that we're talking about particular communities or areas that have been traditionally underserved above and beyond the typical distress criteria that's a requirement of most of EDA's investments. And the final two bullets, I think, are also important to keep in mind. The projects are very much driven by, or successful projects are very much driven by their ability to actually create the jobs. So the commitments of different industries and businesses to whatever grant we're funding is very important. So a community that comes to us, for example, and says that, you know, we're developing a business park and we have a identified tenant who's ready to come, but they just need, you know, we've got to make sure that we have the proper infrastructure in place. That's a more competitive grant from EDA's perspective than one in which a community is simply trying to develop a business park in which, you know, they build it and they hope something will come. Not that we don't fund those, we occasionally will, but again, a stronger application would be one in which there's an identified beneficiary in terms of you know, a business where those jobs are actually going to be there, and that we're actually going to fund. And then finally, just to reiterate the economic distress criteria, that's key. So what we often recommend is even before you contact, you know, your EDD or our EDA's regional offices in your particular point of contact, that you go to statsamerica.org, which is a great site to help you see just not guarantee, but see in a rough way if your particular area or community may qualify under our existing distress criteria. Again, high unemployment, low per capita income. The next couple slides, 34 through, I believe, 37, are a couple examples. The first one, Plainview Steel, is one you probably heard of before, a former Superfund site. We invested just over $750,000 in the construction of a new facility, which is now home to Plainview Steel. It's a good brownfield example, and it shows in terms of the things that we're looking for and the number of jobs that have been created as well as the private investment. The next group of projects are all green-related, and as EDA sustainability coordinator, I like to focus on some of our green investments and just kind of talk a little bit about the variety of things that we could do and the flexibility of EDA investments. The first on slide 35 is an actual renewable energy revolving loan fund that we invested in 2008 and 2009, $500,000 for the Clean Technology and Renewable Energy Revolving Loan Fund. That's to make low-interest loans and longer-term loans to companies that are focused on alternative energy. I think that's a really interesting use of EDA funding, as is slide 36, which I think is interesting because not only is it a LEED certified version of something that we often fund, which is a workforce training center, but not only is it green from a building perspective, but it's also green in terms of what we're doing in that we're the training that's going inside is about green collar training and kind of building the green workforce for the Central Texas area. And finally, slide 37 is an example of use of our Global Climate Change Fund just earlier this year. We invested just over $1 million in the acquisition of a wind turbine in South Dakota that's used as part of a larger wind farm to help train windsmiths. And I think it's a great example of the use of our Global Climate Change Fund and a really good example of a successful public-private partnership. So I guess I'll stop there and take any questions that folks may have about EDA funding.
This is Bahram from Huntington Park in CBE, Los Angeles. I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
When you were talking about, when you're talking about regions, economic regions, is there I'm a little bit new to this, so I was trying to understand. So, what is our economic region in Huntington Park in the Los Angeles County? Is that defined somewhere?
Well, it can be defined a number of different ways. I mean, we do have, like I said, this network of economic development districts, which is a way of defining particular regions. But again, those are limited by political boundaries. So, you know, there may be a reason why this collection of counties have come together. They may have some similar assets that they're leveraging and building upon. But when you think about an economic region, I think you have to think beyond political boundaries and borders. So in many cases, these regions are self-identified in that a group of communities, a group of counties that may cross state boundaries even, have come together to say, you know, we have similar needs, we have similar interests, we have similar assets, and we think we have, the means to grow and to diversify in a particular area, and this is where that is. So some of that may result in, you know, a comprehensive economic development strategy, a roadmap for that particular region. And in other cases, it just may be a particular cluster that has been identified, and there may be things that are being done to kind of build the networks within that. But there's not right now a place where you can go and identify what your regions. We are in the process, actually, it's interesting that you mentioned that, of funding a cluster mapping initiative with Harvard University, where we're actually going to begin the process of trying to map clusters across the United States so that folks could say, okay, you know, here's my community, and I seem to fall within this type of cluster, so maybe in terms of my planning, I should be focusing this on, you know, on X, Y, and Z versus A, B, and C.
Okay. Can I ask one more question about the renewable energy and the climate change mitigation incentive fund? For example, the types of projects that some of the workshops you went in Philadelphia, we heard about a number of projects done in Massachusetts they put, you know, solar generating stations or windmills and wind, you know, turbines and former brownfield sites. Is that something that would qualify for from
potentially, yeah, I mean, it potentially would, but again, it's got to come back to, you know, we don't do green for green's sake alone. I mean, we're doing our investments in environmentally sustainable development come from our belief that, you know, a better way of achieving economic growth is through these green investments. So if these green investments can show the job creation and private capital investment generation that we're looking for with any of our other investments, then they certainly would qualify for the Global Climate Change Fund.
Dave, this is Charlie. I just want to follow, because I think that's an interesting line of thought that the person from California raised. So in this case, like in a scenario, if you had an area project that met the, you know, sort of the criteria and the objectives you just laid out, and it also involved, you know, putting that, you know, new facility, that new green facility, you know, potentially in an older building that you were going to renovate to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So could you then, you know, as part of that, you know, as part of that renovation preparation, I mean, if you needed to take out some asbestos, if you needed to deal with some of that stuff, could that all be folded in this way?
Well, the you mean on the remediation side?
Well, I mean, if that was part of this whole green project that met all the criteria you just laid out.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to brownfields, on the mitigation, the remediation side, we usually come in at the back end. The only time that we would even kind of touch remediation is if it is incidental to the project and, you know, something that we may have come across or maybe a very, you know, minor portion of whatever the reuse or redevelopment of that particular project may be. Does that get to what you were getting at, Charlie?
It does, because I think it's, you know, it's, again, it's not your primary focus, but if you had something that just met all of these other, criteria, and that was a piece of it, then it could work.
Yeah, it has to be incidental. I mean, we really
normally
just don't get in. We come in the back end, so if it's incidental to the major portion of the project, then sure. Any other questions?
Yeah, I had one that came in online here a little while ago, and I think it gets at, you know, sort of the definition of infrastructure. And the specific question is, you know, is the extension of natural gas supply lines an eligible EDA funding activity? But maybe you could touch on whether or not, you know, things are specific or if they're project specific. You know, is there a specific definition of what counts as infrastructure, or is it you sort of judging things on a holistic sort of project basis?
Well, I can speak from just my knowledge of what we have funded in the past, and a lot of the infrastructure has been, as I said, roads, sewers. I know we've done even some bridges, broadband, water, wastewater type of stuff. Could we do gas lines? Yeah, we probably could, but again, it would depend on who the. A lot of it depends. I know that's kind of a cop out in terms of an answer, but a lot of it depends on. What the focus of the project is, who the applicant is, and again, what's the job creation potential of that particular project.
Thanks.
Any other questions?
Sure. I don't have any that came in online. Are there any questions at all for any of the presenters from the folks online or on the phone? Remember, you have to hit #6 to unmute your phone.
This is, again, Bahram from Los Angeles, Huntington Park, working in the Brownfield area, area-wide planning grant. I wanted to know, is it appropriate for us to contact our local representative or regional people for the Department of Commerce to ask more questions, or what's the best way to follow up on some of these issues as they come up as we interact with the community and the stakeholders in creating a plan for our brownfield area and, you know, deciding different things that can potentially fund the strategies for moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my first bit of advice for anyone is to get in touch with your particular regional office, and you can find that all online at www.eda.gov. You'll find our regional offices and the breakdown by state, and you'll actually even be able to find the individuals that are associated with each state. In some cases, those individuals, I'm thinking if we're talking about the West Coast, which is covered by our Seattle regional office, in some cases, the states are covered by individuals who are housed in our regional offices. In other cases, like in California, we may have an individual, an economic development representative, who's actually on the ground in that particular state, who you'll be able to contact and begin the process. And it really does start with a discussion about what you're focused on, what you're doing, and it really is helpful to have that discussion, because what you don't want to do is just, you know, head to the website and begin filling out these applications. You really put yourself in a better position if you have those upfront discussions, and the EDRs can help you kind of shape your overall application if it's appropriate.
I did have a few more of questions that came in online here. First one, if you don't have a CEDS, which is a Comprehensive Economic Development Strategy, but you're in the process of creating one, can you still tap EDA grant funds?
Well, you can. It depends. it depends. Some of our investment programs don't have the SEDS requirement. Our smaller programs, short-term planning, local technical assistance, don't have the SEDS requirement. Our larger, bigger ticket programs, so to speak, public works, economic adjustment assistance, do require that. If you don't have a SEDS, an approved SEDS yet, what it actually says is that to access public works and economic adjustment funds, you need an approved SEDS or the equivalent. So there may be an opportunity to use a different type of planning document as long as it meets EDA requirements. And that'd be something that would be a good conversation to have with the EDA regional office staff.
Great. The second question is, someone wanted you to retouch on the application windows of opportunity for 2011 and 2012.
Okay. They are quarterly. Off the top of my head, I don't have information on 2012. I think the next due date for funding is June 10th or right about there. For funding upcoming in this fiscal year, so that should be the next date you have focus. To be honest, I'm not sure about the date the next date in terms of when funding would be available. So June 10th is what's coming up next.
Thanks. Are there any other questions coming from people participating on the phone lines? Remember #6 to unmute your phone. Well, if there are no other questions, I'd like to direct you to slide 39. Which is our resources and feedback slide. There's a link to additional resources. Additional resources we've already put up there for you, the link that we talked about earlier from the USDA. And we also have a link to the feedback form, and we would appreciate it if you would fill that out. We value your feedback. And with that, if there's no further questions, I'd like to thank both the participants of today's seminar as well as the great information that the presenters have provided for us. And we thank you, and once again, please fill out the feedback form. The link is available through slide 39. Thanks, everybody.